So today we're going to talk about Steiner's 6 basic or protective exercises.
If you are enjoying the work that we are doing here on the Hard Beeswax podcast, please consider making a financial contribution on our Patreon account, which can be found on our website, hardbeeswax.transistor.fm.
If a financial contribution is not in the cards for you, please share our episodes with friends, family, neighbors, or any others who you think might enjoy our show. We thank you all for listening.
We are individuals who are a part of this global educational movement, and we want to be clear that we are only speaking from our own experiences and impressions. We do not presume to speak for the Waldorf movement as a whole. For number one, we have control of thought aims to gain control over what you think.
Number two, control of will aims to gain control of your actions.
Number three, equanimity, the exercise of feeling, aims to be aware of your feelings, to weaken strong feelings and strengthen weak ones, and to balance them.
Number four, positivity aims to see the positive in addition to the bad and the ugly. In this exercise, thinking and feeling are combined.
Number five, open-mindedness aims to be always open to new experiences. In this exercise, feeling and willing are combined.
Number six, inner harmony, the sixth in which the previous exercises need to be practiced in order to create harmony between thinking, feeling, and willing.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Taylor. Yay, a tale from the cosmic bathtub.
Indeed. I know, it's fun. Normally, we're sitting at this table kind of like cocked at a 45-degree angle to face the Zoom computer, and now we get to face each other.
Yeah.
I also didn't have to wash my hair this morning.
And maybe we should just start by talking a little bit about, you know, what our relationship is with these.
Totally. So I think my first awareness of these was listening to my mom talk about something. I think it was the first one, where, you know, the control of thought aims to gain control over what you think, that control of thought exercise. I believe that I have one of those vivid picture memories where she was standing at the kitchen sink talking about the experience of doing that. So I was a child at that point, maybe middle school. And that was my first kind of peripheral awareness that that was something in Steiner's toolbox of stuff that he gave the kind of, I guess, maybe his followers or those who were kind of buying into what he was offering. And then in a professional capacity, I think that my first introduction to the 6 exercises was through my foundation studies, and then again revisited in a way in one of our human development classes.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about you?
So for me, I think the deeper purpose of why these exercises are basic and also protective came about from a lecture series I was listening to from Dennis Klocek. So Dennis Klocek, who actually is my new dream guest. I had to spend the last couple of weeks thinking about who is my next dream guest after speaking to my class teacher, and it would be Dennis Klocek. So Dennis, if you are interested, please give us a call or an email to hardbeeswax.com. I'd love to talk to you.
Sending it out to the GNOME network.
Yep, exactly. Anyway, so Dennis Klocek he had a lecture about the 4 basic elements of the human being, which we already talked about, that the physical, the etheric, the astral, and the ego bodies. And that's also, that reminds me, In that one of our first Tales from the Cosmic Bathtub episode, I presented off the cuff this picture of a river. And what are those four basic elements of a river, if you remember? And I had said, or maybe I was talking with Andy actually about that. And I think that was an episode with Andy. And I said that I made a mistake. So this is actually a correction. I had said that the ego body of a river is actually gravity, not whatever I said. And I think I had said something about like the consciousness of the whole watershed or something, but actually I re-listened to Dennis Klocek and it was very clearly that the ego body of a river is gravity because that's what allows the whole thing to flow in the first place.
Yeah.
So there's a good correction there. But anyway, to go back to the task at hand. So, Dennis spoke about how in the spiritual world, there are sympathetic beings and antipathetic or, you know,
yes.
Counter or I don't want to put a value judgment on it, but there's beings that help us and beings that hinder us.
Working for, working against.
Exactly.
Maybe.
And some of those beings who work against the human beings, they could really eat us for lunch.
Yeah.
You know, and so these exercises, as my understanding from Dennis Klocek, is actually the precondition to be safe in the spiritual world. Hmm. So a lot of people, if they're not prepared and don't have control of themselves in their thinking, in their willing, and in their feeling, can either be totally deceived or what they see and they perceive to be true is not there, or they bring it back and pretend like, oh, now I'm somebody, and they prepare to, you know, teach essentially out of all false principles. So for me, these six exercises are, they're a lifelong practice that you start to then take control of yourself in a moral, spiritual way.
Yeah, I really like that explanation. Can you talk a little bit about your experience doing these?
Yeah. So I feel like I'm kind of a repentant and I need to kind of almost go to like anthroposophical confession, because I know about these exercises and I've tried to practice them, and it's actually very challenging. And I found actually that I've tended to do not as much practice in this realm as I should.
Yes.
And it feels a little bit like I'm a lapsed, you know, anthroposophical appreciation, someone who appreciates it, but has a hard time practicing it.
And I think that is what, to me, right from the get, is so fascinating about the quality of these exercises, is that they are so incredibly simple and yet they're incredibly revealing.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in our world, especially, there, we are kind of, I almost want to say this is clumsy wording, but we are under threat of having our attention hijacked at all times.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I notice it in myself. I notice it in those around me. And these exercises, wow, do they put up a mirror to that,
right,
to that shortcoming. You know, Matthew and I, we've been talking about wanting to talk about these exercises. And in addition, you know, trying to put some of them into practice. So, yeah. I have been trying for maybe the last 3 or 4 weeks to at 4:05 p.m. do exercise number one, which has you do a particular series of actions. Is this number one or is it number two?
Control of will?
Yes, control of will.
He has it as number one.
Okay.
So, but before we go into the specific, if I may.
Yeah, sorry.
So I didn't actually answer your question before. I did practice these exercises through my teacher training, is where I first really encountered them.
All of these are meditative in nature.
Yeah. And they're not religious per se. You can be of any stripe and still practice these as a meditative exercise for a couple minutes.
Yes.
A day.
It's like a honing of attention and intention.
Yeah.
Through these that I feel like that's what on the surface, as far as direct impact into your current human life. That's where I immediately felt that these exercises were working. So starting with control of thought, I think this is the one that everyone always thinks of.
Yeah.
Is the use an ordinary object, a pencil, clothespin, clip, book, etc., and think about it for 5 minutes every day.
And that literally means like take a stopwatch, put 5 minute or timer, put it in for 5 minutes, and then you're supposed to just look at your pen or pin. I remember I've always called it the pin exercise because it was supposed to be something very common.
Yes. I did a water glass, like a really, really standard tapered toward the top, outward, very clear glass.
Yeah.
Heavy water glass.
And then just to kind of explain, you're supposed to think about that pin, where it came from, what it looks like, what color, you know, all. And the point of it being a very common object is that you'll find that it's very hard to continuously think about that common object for even 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, I mean, I'm not trying to give anything away, but you'll find that your mind starts to wander all over the place and you're looking at this pin. And then in the next second, you're thinking about, you know, the grocery list and all the tasks that you have to do. And you realize that, as it said, that you think unconsciously, and it's very hard for us as human beings to actually gain control of our thinking ability.
And I think something about this is that there are elements of it to, you know, I don't even know, maybe transcendental meditation, right? Some of these more maybe Eastern inspired meditation traditions where I've heard it described in so many different ways, where you're sitting there and you are either clearing your mind or you are watching as if a bystander, the thoughts go by in your head, right? There are elements of those kinds of indications around meditation in this, except that in addition to stepping away from your thoughts, you are also simultaneously holding something very, very specific in your mind's eye.
You're holding something specific and then observing yourself thinking about it,
mm-hmm.
and observing how easily your mind slips away from that attention. And I think...
So I have an observation about myself when I do this. And this is, again, probably, I don't know why, but when I do this exercise, imagining a water glass, when I feel myself wandering, I find myself manipulating the size of the object, like either zooming really far out or zooming really far in. And for some reason, I have a much harder time imagining it getting smaller than I do imagining it getting larger.
Mm.
So I have this, you know, this endlessly looming water glass there. I'm, you know, that's just getting larger and larger. And the curve of the cup is getting shallower and shallower as it grows. Whereas then when it's smaller, it's almost like it creates space for other thoughts to wander in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like Matthew said, it's just observing yourself in thinking, because thinking is so frequently an unconscious thing.
Right. And then when you do recognize that you're way off track or you're thinking about your grocery list or whatever, the point of the exercise then is to interrupt that and say, oh, wait, I'm supposed to be thinking of the pin or whatever, and then to refocus your attention on it.
Okay, should we go to number two?
Yep.
Okay. Exercise number two, control of will, acting on your own initiative. So this is the one that I've been trying to do for the last 4 weeks, which is do a simple act without purpose at a fixed time each day.
Yeah. And without purpose is, you know, you can take, if you're married, you can take your ring off your finger, flip it around and put it back on. You could do a clapping sequence or,
some people like move an object, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if there's a vase, you move it to the right.
Or a potted plant that you turn a quarter of a way around, or something that you'll always have close by.
Uh-huh. And the idea of doing it at a fixed time every day. Yeah, this one was so humbling to try to do. I was telling Matthew that my plan was to do a basic, you know, clapping sequence of a kind of a clap against my chest, a snap, and then a clap with my hands together at 4:05 p.m. every day, because I'm almost always home at that time. And it was incredibly challenging. I thought about it at least once every day. Right. There wasn't a day that went
before
by.
Or after.
Both. I would think about it at 10 a.m. and say, oh, OK, cool. Time is going to keep on going. And at 4:05, I'm going to remember. And the closest I ever got was 4:08. I got within 3 minutes. And I again, it's just the diagnostic element is just really, really amazing because of how easily we are distracted, how you can be wholly focused on something and thinking about something and then forget it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about the fact that most of us now not only rely on a calendar to document things, but then a audio and visual alert to remind us of the coming of that thing. And this really challenges your mind to do all of that. And the fact that the action is something that does not have purpose. It's not like taking the trash out every day. It's not like, you know, watering a plant. It is literally just an action for action's sake to test the part of you that takes a thought and puts it into action.
Absolutely. And I in addition, you have, you know, this cultivation of your initiative, but it's also coming solely from yourself. So often I find myself doing things because my son needs something or my wife, or it's dinner time. And then the purpose of this is to set a simple task, a goal out of yourself for yourself, and then to recognize, you know, how hard it is to meet that. Because it sounds really simple. At 5:06 p.m., I will flip my ring over on my finger or something. And then, you know, how do you, you're essentially starting a new habit, right?
Yes.
And then how do you say, okay, I'm going to do this. And then you realize I can't. And then, I'm going to have a better intention. And
Yeah. And it's such a good example of will. In action, right? Of this is an act of will, because I feel like that is one of those things that is a word thrown around in Waldorf schools. You know, what is the will? Mm-hmm. And this is truly an exercise of the will.
Yeah.
Of taking something from thought, initiating
an action,
and doing an action out of that.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of. There's a really nice PDF of all of this. Just to let you all know, it's from Tom Van Gelder. You can just Google it online. And some of the tips he has to make this exercise more successful is that you choose a time that's more easy for you. Also to imagine yourself the night before doing it at that right time.
To take that image into your sleep.
Yes.
The night before.
Definitely. Treat it with humor, right? Please don't get depressed that you're not doing it, right? And, you know, maybe the author Tom also talks about scaffolding it, you know, like giving yourself a reminder and then slowly letting go of those reminders. But I don't know if that's really.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on to number three. So equanimity, the exercise of feelings. I have a story about this one. I mean, I remember from my training about this one. But so equanimity, the exercise of feelings. So observe your feelings, restrain strong responses, and strengthen feeble ones. Okay, so as this exercise is not done with an object or at a fixed time, but throughout the day, when something happens to you, look at your feelings either in that moment or later.
So it's really just taking this observational lens and turning it inward into feelings.
Right.
In the wake of an event.
Right. So I think for me, oftentimes this goes kind of together with what in my training was called the Rückschau or the evening review. And the evening review, it had a little bit of a different purpose, but in that you're kind of observing yourself, how you and your feelings, and you're saying, oh, this happened to me and I felt this way. Or, and it, so it's a way to start to tease out kind of the emotional storm that you find yourself in your daily life. Like, okay, you know, somebody beeped at me and I got upset and then I beeped at them and, you know, like, or if you're driving or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I was like, why are people beeping at you, Matthew? I was having a hard time with that image, but yes, driving. Or I even think like noticing that when, you know, if you are cut off, your first response is rage or indignation or, you know, it's like observing that unconscious wave that arises, you know, that, I love this sentence here. Feelings are like the weather. They are just there. We experience them, but unlike the weather, we can adjust our reaction by our thoughts, right? If it's like turning your thinking toward these feelings that arise.
And basically name them. I think from my personal experience, I often wouldn't recognize when I was angry. And I often, people would tell me, why are you so angry with me? And I'd be like, I'm not angry with you. I'm just thinking about something. Or my students would say that to me because I'd have a very severe look on my face. And for most teenagers, you know, it's either love, hate. Like, you love me. Why do you hate me? It's like, I have nothing to do. You know, my emotion, like I'm trying to understand how to teach you this algebra problem. And I'm just thinking, but for you, that's coming across as being, you know, I'm angry with you.
Yeah.
So it's a way, I think, for us to name and say, oh, I'm actually feeling jealousy, or I'm feeling envious, or I'm feeling, you know, whatever that emotion is, to kind of tease that out and to recognize that we tend to want to be sympathetic. We tend to want to, you know, always feel nice and happy. And so we tend to magnify or what's the opposite of magnify? Diminish.
Yeah, diminish.
Diminish the negatives, you know? And so, so you start to understand, you start to see yourself in the feeling life of your family and then your social sphere, your work environment and so on.
I think this exercise is especially powerful for teachers because I think that in, you know, as a teacher, you know, you are standing in a room in front of young growing people and it is so not their job to, you know, to know, like, to know what are your soft spots or, you know, and there's just inevitably things that they will say that will strike a chord that catches you by surprise. Right.
Right.
And I think that we who are teachers have a responsibility to do this kind of work so that the reaction that comes is one that is appropriate in a classroom setting.
Right.
You know, I think back of, you know, there were always particular students or particular academic situations that would come up around, you know, asking for, like, whatever it may be, asking for an extension or, you know, everyone coming together and saying, we didn't understand the homework when you thought you explained it to within an inch of its life, right? and we all have those moments where we that are just like a bruise. And I think that teachers really have, I personally feel that teachers have a real responsibility to be with these, to be with feelings, to see them, and yet to be able to say, okay, in this moment is not the place for this feeling to explode outward.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot about, I had one moment last year where it was particularly challenging to be a mother to a baby, and we had not slept, and it was the kind of, it had been the kind of night where the, you know, the in the sleep deprived haze, you know, my husband and I were just like, somehow this is your fault and somehow this is my fault. And, you know, it was just like everyone's nervous system was totally shot. And it was the beginning of the class with the seniors, and I just started crying. And the first thing that I felt was real embarrassment.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I feel really strongly about being a teacher and being professional. And that moment did not feel professional.
Right.
And I was facing the board, and I was like, okay, is this the kind of, can I sniff it away? Can I subtly wipe at my sleeve and get rid of it and turn around and pull off, you know, pull off the disguise? I definitely didn't pull off the disguise, and immediately, you know, they kind of gave me that look of like, oh gosh, what's going on with you? But it was a moment that I think back on a lot, because it was a day where I did not take the time to sit down with those feelings and name them. And they were coming out whether I wanted them to or not. And because I hadn't taken the time earlier to say, okay, all right, what are we dealing with here? Let's pass it through. Let's, you know, that it welled up in a time that, you know, and to the students' credit, they were all incredibly kind. And one of the students even stayed behind after class and said, you know, Ms. Romans, one time when I was having a really bad day, you like let me off the hook and gave me a hug. So I'd like to offer to give you a hug now. And, you know, like there are always those moments where it ends up being very, very beautiful, but it is also, you know, a real, a potential hazard. And that's an example of, you know, of like overwhelm and sadness. But I think anger can come out that way.
Yeah.
All of those things.
And as high school teachers, you know, we're supposed to be teaching out of our ego body, because the students are the ones who are living out of their feeling life, their astral body, and learning the tools to how to control that. And us standing in front of the room is, you know, ideally should have all those tools already set. And of course we're coming in cool as a cucumber.
Always.
And you know, and then, you know, and then when this a student has a bad day or, you know, is angry, and it just allows a teacher ideally to, you know, their hair gets blown around a little bit in the storm or whatever. But, you know, that's really kind of an ideal picture. And we are feeling human beings, and we have professional lives and we have personal lives. And I think the big thing about striving to teach out of one's ego is to recognize, okay, in this place and time, you know, my feelings are important, but if someone drops an F-bomb, you know, or tells me that I'm doing something wrong, you know, I have to meet that in a professional way.
Yeah.
And that's really important. So, yeah. I mean, I think that the two main things, though, I just want to highlight is fear and anger. I think often we anger is somehow an easy emotion in some ways.
Yes.
But fear, and then that leads into anxiety. I think fear is a big one that I've seen a rise of fear and anxiety in the students that I worked with.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of how do I, as a teacher, bring my ego presence and not use, especially in mathematics, say, oh, this is just such an easy problem.
Yes.
It's nothing about the problem. The student probably actually knows the answer, but there's so much anxiety and fear wrapped around that, that it's, you know, my job was more and more like saying, okay, like, you know, dealing with anxiety and fear rather than dealing mm-hmm. with the specific math lesson.
Yeah. You're almost dealing more with encouraging the individual in their own capabilities than actually teaching them how to look at the numbers in front of them.
Right. And so then it's like, I think the other part of this exercise is then interrupting the natural feedback that you give. So
yes.
if I may, you know, maybe with some road rage, you know, if you typically, you know, say something like, oh, that, you know, whatever, or you just cut me off, you know, would be then to interrupt that and not to actually curse, let's say.
Yes.
And then say, oh, I don't actually, I'm not on a timeline. It's okay if I, if I let this person go or, you know, so you're in all of these exercises, you're bringing more consciousness into that activity. And if you recognize that you tend to get angry when you drive a car and then you stop and say, ah, I don't actually need to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to do in the moment, but if you're constantly trying to interrupt unconscious processes and then supplanting them with conscious ones.
Tying it back to us teaching high school students, that is the power of modeling at the high school level.
Yes.
Is to be, you know, to have someone come in going off the rails at a 10 decibel, you know, to like coming in hot, as I would say, and to meet them with some, not to dismiss, but to meet them with some
true human
care.
Yeah.
And resolve,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, steadiness, resolve, true human care, yeah.
You know, I would always think about that as a coach of, you know, what did I do when a ref made a bad call? What did I do when someone bumped into, you know, when one of our smallest players got body checked and, you know, went flying 4 feet in the air? What did I do, right? Mm. And I think that is, you know, all of these exercises have incredible personal gain.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
There's so much on a personal level, but I think that when we look at a lot of the people who are encouraged to take these exercises on are teachers in a Waldorf school who mm-hmm. are encouraged to do this as a part of becoming the kinds of human beings who we as a community want standing in front of our children.
Absolutely. Yeah. So being able to recognize that you are not your feelings, that you have them, that just leads into having, keeping one's composure.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And the next one.
Positivity. Observing the positive. Always try to see the positive aspects of something negative.
Yeah. So this one is the story that comes to mind is the one that was told to me in my training, which was the story of when Jesus Christ was walking and he saw the corpse of a dog mm-hmm. or something. I don't remember exactly where this is in the Bible, but he was looking at a corpse of a dog and it might've been smelling or something. And I guess Jesus looked at it and said, oh, that dog has really beautiful white teeth or something like that. So that was the story. It's like you take something that you have a non-sympathetic or antipathetic reaction to, and then you try to find something in that reaction to that's positive. So another example maybe that's not biblical is, you know, a compost pile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you... usually you, I mean, at least my compost pile, you approach it and it kind of smells and you're like, but then you realize, well, wait a minute, that's the food for the garden.
Yep.
You know,
I think that this, at the risk of sounding grandiose, I think this is something that I do without even being aware that it's one of Steiner's exercises, right? Yeah. And I think a lot of times where I, you know, where I see, I think it's very easy to apply this in the physical world, but I think that in the world of human community and in the world of kind of human relationships, that this is harder. And I think that I especially saw this challenge with our students. And I think it's a result of so many things. It's just like, it's just our world right now that we live in a time where there's like, there are good things and there are bad things.
Yeah. The judgment is very clearly made.
Yes. The judgment is clearly made, and that the value judgment of something, that there are value judgments that go with so many things, and that there are a whole series of assumptions about where one lands on these particular value judgments. And I think, I'm honestly not sure, is this the exercise or is it something entirely different where you look at things that are on the cusp of life and death? Or is that something different? Because I feel like that ties into this as well.
It could be. I think so.
Because yes. That was something that's what I truly remember doing in my foundations work. Mm-hmm. And it was actually around this time of year to where there was all of this decay, all the dead plants, all the skeletal leaves, and then these early green shoots coming up. Mm-hmm. And that I kind of took that more as a meditative exercise of not thinking rationally, but just observing those places. And I found that to be really powerful. But I think that also the just finding the balance of two sides is just so, yeah, it's important and I think undervalued.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're combining in this exercise the thinking with the feeling. And So one of the things that this exercise is trying to show us is that we don't want our feeling life. So we don't want our sympathies and antipathies. We don't want our feelings to distract us from actually thinking things through, being able to perceive. So, you know, if you look at a rotting plum, you'd be like, oh, it's rotting. And then not perceive any deeper. Like,
like that's a check. It's rotting. It's done.
Yeah. It's not part of my life.
Yeah.
But or I can imagine maybe this is kind of like the discovery of penicillin, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, like, I have moldy bread again instead of just chucking it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I totally made that up. But so not to have our feeling life cloud our perception, but in searching for something positive, you allow that extra question or two to your perception to see into something that you might have just write off very easily. And then you're also always striving to become independent of your feelings. I think so. That's what this exercise, by joining your thinking into your feeling, you are in a process of learning to separate from your feelings. And I think that's really important so that you're not ruled by those feelings.
Yeah. And I think that it's easy to jump to the conclusion that this is a kind of like a quashing or a shoving aside of feelings. And I think it's not that. It's a stepping back from, it's like taking the wheel back so that your feelings aren't the ones at the helm. You know, because feelings happen so fast. I think that's the thing that that I'm seeing in this exercise is, you know, even just the basic premise that there are things that are categorized as positive and negative. I didn't even think twice about that when I read, you know, when I was reading through learning about the exercises. Yeah, of course there are things that I view as positive and negative.
Right.
When in fact, even that in and of itself is shows just the rapid categorization of the world that we have into, you know, sympathies and antipathies.
Right.
And that taking and challenging that initiative positive association, then just doing, bringing thought into that, then allows you to bring cognition and not, you may still take the same action, but you had a moment of looking really honestly at what that was, trying to see both sides
And
before moving forward.
Absolutely. And I think the goal of this is to just increase your tolerance.
Yeah.
So when you're constantly trying to say, okay, but where's the positive? Even in this, you know, in this situation, it seems totally, totally black. There's always probably a little bit of a silver lining somewhere. And to figure that out allows for greater tolerance.
Tolerance and, I think, empathy. Because if something is simply bad, then you think nothing of stomping on it or throwing it in the trash or dismissing it or ignoring it. And yet, if it is multidimensional, then it brings in more, it like almost brings morality.
Yeah. Well, it allows you to change your mind,
yes.
Right? Because if you are if you have years and years of thinking that this is good or this is bad, like how do you start to change that? You tend to, you have to start seeing something from a different perspective. And
yes.
I think to gain from that different perspective means that you start to, especially if something is all bad in your opinion, then to ask yourself the question, well, what's good in this is that first step of changing your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I just add, you know, as a footnote, this is all easy to say and really hard to do.
Really hard.
So, yeah. Okay. And I think we're at 6 now, which is,
this is five.
Yeah, five. Okay. So open-mindedness, to be open to new experiences, always keep open the possibility to experience something new and to keep in mind that new experiences can counter old ones. So if I may just jump in here a second, I want to give a shout out to a series of a book series for children, and I'll get the name in just a second. It's those green ones over there. Do you see that one?
Yes.
And in those books.
De Francesca.
Yeah. They're books of the gnomes. And I read this. Yeah, so this is called The Way of the Gnome.
The Way of Gnome, The Tales of Limendore Woods, Sieglinde de Francesca.
Yeah, I highly recommend this series of books. I read them to my six-year-old. And in that book, if I could just have the bookmark there. Oh, is this the bookmark? Oh, it's not the correct one. Here it is. So in this book, it's a children's story with gnomes and children who meet gnomes and everything. It's very cute. It's very, it's very sweet. And the point of all this is that the author here has the golden rules of gnome, and there's 6 of them. And, if I may, the first one is to be kind always. 2 is to tell the truth always, and if you feel you can't, it is best to say nothing. 3, to be generous, to always offer a gift when you meet someone. If you don't have a gift, a song, sing a song, tell a story, or give creatively in some other way. Even a smile or hug will do. 4, to keep tidy. This is mainly a matter of keeping things in order and clean. And then finally, to celebrate every day. And then the 6th one is to find your gift. But the reason I'm saying this is this number 5, to celebrate every day. I think that as a rule, that is really interesting. And if you're trying to celebrate, something new, you know, you tend to celebrate, at least in my family, we tended to celebrate when we learned something new or we had a new experience. So if you're always trying to keep open the possibility to experience something new, the reason I'm saying this is that it might be good because to try to celebrate it, you know, I don't know if that makes a direct connection, but it definitely made me look around my daily life and say, you know, maybe this day seems like every other day, but what is it that I could celebrate? And that tended to be something new or a new experience or observation or something like that.
Yeah. I think that my son is a little over two, which means he's very mobile and very curious. And going outside on walks with him totally stimulates this because he is constantly going in completely unexpected directions. A path is a mere suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found myself, you know, stumbling, you know, to the backside of a stump that I've never looked at ever. And, you know, that I remember, you know, being a Waldorf kid, no TV, long car trips. It was like, we're listening to 70s folk music or you're staring out the window and just thinking.
Yeah.
And I remember we'd be going down the highway and I'd like focus my eye in on one particular leaf. And I would always wonder, I wonder if I'm the first person who's ever looked at that leaf. Or like climbing between two tree limbs at a funny angle. I wonder if I'm the first person who's ever walked between a tree limb. And you know, and those are all qualities that we don't think twice of being parts of childhood, but at some point go away.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so how do you bring those back?
Yeah. And so from a higher angle going down into our experience, this is a combination of combining thinking with willing. So it's how do we keep ourselves open to new experiences and have that action be kind of habitual rather than being constantly closed off, right? I already know everything.
Yes.
Right? That's the opposite gesture. Like, don't tell me, you know, for me in teaching, that was often, I know I would get a question like, can you explain that in a different way? You know,
yeah.
So it was always like, how do I explain, you know, some random algebra process? You know, how could I explain this in a different way? Does it need color? Does it need sound? Do you need to have an idea as a goal? Okay, we're trying to, you know, get all the X's on one side. You know, so I guess for me, it was always like, okay, how could I explain this in a different way or some physics, you know, idea or question.
And I think the thinking element is that, again, so much of our action is habit. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at conscious action versus unconscious action, and so much of my day is unconscious action. So many of the places where I drive, I do not need to be actively looking at street signs because I know my subconscious knows where we're going. And I think that then when you bring thought into those habits, then you see the open doors where you could do something new.
Yeah.
And even if it's driving a different way or, you know, trying a new restaurant or saying hello to someone who you walk past every day and normally just smile at, you know, like those little different things. And you have to bring thinking consciousness into those actions in order to identify where those opportunities are and then harness the will into actually taking that step in that new direction.
Yeah. And I think I want to also talk about letting events speak for themselves, because you have to train yourself in thinking and willing that it's not sometimes it's not about what you do, but it's that you are open and you are keeping your judgments back from allowing the world to then speak for itself. Hmm. So like if you were thinking sense free, right? If you didn't have your body anymore, I mean, that's kind of where we're going with all of these exercises, right? It's like, okay, I know I can now, I can now think, right? I've done the pin exercise enough that I can focus on something for a decent amount of time, but maybe this isn't just about me anymore. Hmm. I think with thinking and willing, there's you acting in the world, but then there's you holding back and letting the world unfold and understanding what that message is. Hmm. That's part of this exercise as well.
The author of this, of kind of our reference document that we're working from, uses the like the term curiosity, right? Of like meeting the world with curiosity and open-mindedness. You know, this is going in a kind of maybe a bit of a stretch, but something I always think about is the people who knew what they wanted to do when they were 12, you know, and they all through high school, then they gravitated toward the classes that would move them in the direction of what they were going to do. And the other classes they met with, well, I don't really need this because I'm not going to do that.
Right.
Then they apply to colleges that reinforce the, that's what I'm going to do professionally someday. They study that thing and then they come out the other end and then they do it. And I always had a little warning bell in my head about that. And I think we live in a time that celebrates that as direction and passion. And we really celebrate that kind of decisiveness. And yet, I think that that is an incredibly closed off. And it you end up missing all of the ways the world could have worked through you, almost, right? You miss all of those little side doors that maybe if at any point you kind of lifted your head up above the water and looked around, that there might have been a different opportunity that could have turned into something great. And that was always something that I thought about when I was, you know, when I was a college guidance counselor. And but I think it ties into this a little bit with the, you know, to be so single-mindedly focused on one outcome that which is a challenge because we celebrate that. We look at those people and say, wow, gosh, if only I was like them.
Yeah.
If only I had their direction and their their stick-to-itiveness. And when in fact I think there's real
value.
Yeah, value to that open-eyed curiosity and, you know, and, you know, accepting those invitations when they come.
Yeah,
even
absolutely.
If it's in an unexpected direction.
I can't help but maybe doing a little bit of a tangent here and talking about this exercise in terms of poker games.
Oh!
Because one of the best things I ever did to become a better high school teacher was to learn to play poker. And I was so bad at it. I had all my emotions on my face. You know, I'd get a good hand and my eyebrows would shoot up and everybody would fold or my hand would shake. And so, but one of the things that's really interesting about this, about poker, is that it's only half. The cards in your hand is only half the, you know, the play.
Yeah.
The other half of the play is learning to learn the read and understand the people you're playing with, right? And so to play on how they're thinking. And then eventually you get to this point where it doesn't really matter what the cards you have are. I mean, it does, you know. But so for me, to this idea of holding myself expressionless And then seeing the world around me, in quotations, being the other poker players at the table, and then watching how they play, and then betting accordingly, or yeah. playing off their fears and anxieties and anger. luckily, there was no guns under the table or anything. But that was a really powerful lesson for me. Mm-hmm. And to hold myself, yeah, anyway.
I like, that's a great yeah. example.
Yeah. All right. We're on the last one, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Inner harmony, creating balance. Practice the 5 previous exercises separately and in various combinations as needed so that harmony exists between thinking, feeling, and willing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think big picture, we tend to, as human beings, really channel one or the other. We tend to be, you know, thinkers, and some people tend to be doers, and then some people live strongly in their emotional life. Mm-hmm. I can imagine, I always sat next to Daniel Winland, and, you know, and for me, what he did was like almost pure will. Like I could, you know,
yeah.
he was just scheduling everything and then gardening and then yeah. going out and doing the PE and the movement classes.
Making phone calls all the time.
I mean, he could hardly sit in his seat, you know, and you know, I could just realize, oh, this is a person who's has a lot of will forces, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he also his body. I mean, he was ripped, and he was like totally, you know, he just lived in the world. And for me, you know, I felt much more. You know, I'd like to sit in my desk and think about things, and it's like I could really think about doing some exercise right now. But I kind of like just sitting, you know. Anyway, it's just so funny so I think we see these kind of predominant traits, right? Mm-hmm. And so in this exercise, we're really trying to then practice those other skills. You know, for me, it would be, you know, going to the gym on a regular yeah. basis or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think that part of this 6th exercise is to, in addition to just identifying your own tendencies, is then at any particular time, identifying which exercise would best meet the where you need balance.
Yeah.
Because as we said, each of these exercises is either playing on one or many of these kind of 3 different forces. Mm-hmm. And that at times one is needed, at time another is needed, and that they can all work together in various potencies depending on the needs of each individual. And that requires some consciousness to be able to identify that, yeah. right? That kind of only through the cultivation of attention, self-reflection,
yeah.
really honestly being able to name those feelings, identify them through thinking, that only through that then could someone on any given day do that inner scan and say, okay, I am feeling, or, you know, I need this, this exercise to support me in this area.
Yeah. And I think it is true that when you start to intentionally do something right away, there's going to be some oppositional forces.
Yeah.
So you definitely have to take these exercises with humor and take it easy on yourself.
Yeah.
And it's okay if you've set them aside. You know, I don't know how many people do this regularly, but I think if you do these exercises, maybe you practice just one for 1 week or one for 1 month. There's no set, you know, prescription. And they do, I think they are basic. They are protection. And I think it's really important, especially if you want to dive in deeper into the anthroposophical world, that you really have a command of yourself. You have to kind of achieve some level of maturity before you start to go into some of the other deeper explorations.
Yeah.
Steiner often talks about people not being ready to understand some of the deeper truths, and then that gets all misinterpreted and
yeah.
misunderstood. And then how many Steiner lectures is like, if you don't read this the right way,
yeah.
you know, it's like, I hate those parts always kind of annoy me because yeah. it's like, of course, you you have to, before you step into the world, you have to mature, right? And so I think that's what this is about.
Yeah, and I think it is, it's like honing the skill set that you need to take on, you know, so much of this comes back to like living thinking for me. Mm-hmm. And the idea, you know, that for those listening, that was the course that Douglas talked about, you know, about creating, and, you know, that really kind of put a, maybe put a magnifying glass on the quality of thinking that would be required in order to, you know, to do the teaching work that Steiner laid out. And, you know, there is, I think that I have read a lot of Steiner at this point in my life, and yet I do not at any point sit back and say, yeah, I understood all of that. And I see in my own self a lot of work still to be done in these areas, and a lot of again, of just taking ownership of my own mind.
Mm-hmm. And purifying.
And yeah, and purifying it. And mm-hmm. It's so funny because I think that with a slight change in vocabulary, half of these things would sound like what people are doing in therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, and that in so many cases it is, you know, hey, well, have you thought about what this person might be seeing from their perspective?
Yeah, exactly.
Or, you know, like when when someone behaves in this way, take a moment to observe your reaction before verbally responding, right? And so many of that is people seem to be hungry for tools to take
control of themselves.
Take control of themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that these exercises are really could even in the short term be viewed as a really valid path for someone who hungers for that.
Absolutely. We had a conference almost a decade ago about these six exercises where we brought Jamin McMillan in for some spatial dynamics. And so hopefully we'll speak to him sometime.
Yes.
And can talk about how you would do these, what are some of the movements related to these exercises that he's developed. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. There's a therapeutic aspect to this, as well as a foundation or kind of entry level purpose for deeper spiritual understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts on these exercises or?
I would like us, if you're willing, Taylor, to take up the first two and we'll do it for a month maybe until, and then at the next Tales from the Cosmic Bathtub, we'll talk about it again and see what it is. So this is the pin and the will exercise, moving something and then maybe thinking about something.
Yeah? I am in, and
if anybody else would like to join, we'll post this PDF onto the show notes on our page.
Yep, we'll have this this PDF, which is just a great source of information with explanations on our website. And we encourage anyone else who'd like to take this on with us to join in. And along the way, if anyone wants to share maybe their experiences or questions or things that come up, feel free to send us an email at hardbeeswax@gmail.com. Or you can always reach out on social media. We are on Facebook and Instagram as hardbeeswax.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This is fun to have a dialogue.
I know, definitely. And thanks to our listeners. And we'll see you next time around.
Take care. Would you like to be a sponsor on Hard Beeswax? Email us at hardbeeswax@gmail.com.
That concludes another episode of Hard Beeswax. Thanks for listening. For episodes and more, please visit our website, hardbeeswax.transistor.fm.